Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present John Wolfstall, Director of Global Risk at the Federation of American Scientists, who explains why the symbolic doomsday clock was recently moved closer to midnight and potential global catastrophe. Victor Picard, Professor of Media Policy at the University of Pennsylvania, who assesses the danger posed to democracy by Trump-aligned billionaire oligarchs reshaping the U.S. media industry. And Adam Hoffner, director of the first-year building project at the Yale School of Architecture, who talks about how his students design and build new rent-free homes for early childhood educators. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Last September, the Supreme Court lifted a lower court's temporary restraining order in Los Angeles that prohibited ICE agents from stopping people solely based on their race, ethnicity, language, or location. In the case Noem v. Perdomo, the High Court's 6-3 emergency order set a dangerous precedent that now allows ICE officers to use racial profiling to stop and question individuals. In October, ICE agents targeted Black residents in Lower Manhattan and Chicago's South Side neighborhoods, highlighting the Black community's vulnerability to brutal immigration enforcement and long-standing racial bias in the U.S. criminal justice system. Today, Black residents make up 5.4% of America's undocumented population, yet they constitute more than 20% of migrants facing deportation. Although non-citizens from all backgrounds can be and are affected by the violent and inhumane characteristics of Trump's mass deportation campaign, Blacks experience the disproportionate brunt of this injustice. The leaders of African nations are pushing to have colonial-era crimes recognized, criminalized, and addressed through reparations. At a late November conference in the Algerian capital, Algiers, diplomats and leaders convened to advance an African Union resolution passed at a meeting earlier last year calling for justice and reparations for victims of colonialism. International conventions and statutes accepted by a majority of the world's countries have outlawed practices, including slavery, torture, and apartheid. But while the United Nations Charter prohibits the seizure of territory by force, it does not explicitly reference colonialism. Algerian Foreign Minister Ahmed Attaf declared that Algeria's experience of torture, disappeared persons, and devastated villages under French rule underscores the need to seek compensation and reclaim stolen property. A legal framework, he added, would ensure restitution is seen as neither a gift nor a favor. The economic cost of colonialism to Africans is estimated to have exceeded trillions of dollars. In the 1900s, European powers extracted natural resources, often through brutal methods, enriching occupiers with gold, diamonds, rubber, and other valuable natural resources. Before it invaded Ukraine, Russia was Europe's single largest supplier of imported natural gas. But as the Ukraine war continued for nearly 4 years, the European Union is now considering an outright ban on all Russian gas by the end of 2027. With one of its most important markets drying up, Russia has pivoted to Asia. In September last year, Russia and China signed a legally binding memorandum to advance a 2,600-kilometer pipeline which will transport gas from Russia's Yamal Peninsula to China via Mongolia, aiding Russia's move away from European markets. Moscow and Beijing strengthened their energy ties despite U.S. sanctions targeting major Russian oil companies like Rosneft and Lukoil. Jack Herndon of the Center for European Policy Analysis in Washington maintains that China seems to have a get-out-of-jail-free card regarding U.S.-Russia energy sanctions. He said China thinks it has the upper hand because Trump wants to finalize a trade agreement, so they think they can get away with this for now. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Just 2 years after the United States launched the world's first and only use of atomic weapons in war against the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945, the publication Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, founded by Manhattan Project physicists and scientists, initiated their annual setting of the symbolic doomsday clock. Since 1947, the Bulletin scientists and other experts on threats to humanity have reset the minute hand on the doomsday clock 27 times. In late January, the clock's minute hand was moved from 89 seconds to midnight to 85 seconds to midnight, the closest this symbolic timepiece has ever been to potential catastrophe in nearly 70 years. Explaining their decision to move the clock forward, the Bulletin Science and Security Board cited a failure of global leadership on threats to humanity and called for urgent action to limit nuclear weapons arsenals, create international guidelines on the use of artificial intelligence, address the runaway climate crisis, and form multilateral agreements to address global biological threats. Your reporter spoke with John Wolfstall, Director of Global Risk at the Federation of American Scientists and a member of the Bulletin Science and Security Board, who formerly served as Special Assistant to President Obama for National Security Affairs, and was Senior Director at the National Security Council for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. Here he discusses some of the serious threats facing humanity that led to moving the doomsday clock closer to midnight.
There are three major threats that go into setting the clock every year: nuclear weapons threats, the threat of climate change, and the threat of disruptive technology, including both artificial intelligence and misinformation, disinformation, but also disruptive technology like bioengineering and the possibility of man-made pandemics. The clock has moved around a lot over the decades. At one point, it was 17 minutes away from midnight, but this past week, we set the clock at 85 seconds to midnight, 4 seconds closer to doomsday, as a sign of how dangerous the world is, but also in our view, how poorly the world's leaders, including in the United States and elsewhere, are doing in terms of focusing on these threats and trying to take the action that we know is possible to protect humanity from these threats coming to pass.
You know, I wanted to look at the nuclear threat first. It's auspicious that February 4th, the last remaining nuclear arms treaty between the United States and Russia, something called New START, will expire. As someone who is a nuclear arms expert, tell us about the significance of this date. Again, it's the last nuclear arms treaty.
Well, I'm more than just a nuclear expert. I'm actually somebody who helped negotiate and gain government ratification for that treaty when I worked for President Obama and Vice President Biden. So I'm not completely unbiased here. But I think it's fair to say just the facts that for the last 53 years, the United States and the Soviet Union, and after it, Russia, had agreed, even when we pointed nuclear weapons at each other, even when we fought proxy wars, that it was a bad thing for us both to live in a world where either side could deploy as many nuclear weapons as we wanted. Arms racing is dangerous. Runaway nuclear arms competition is something that can lead to mistakes and accidents and crises. And so we agreed, whether it was under Brezhnev and Johnson and Nixon and Andropov or Reagan and Gorbachev, that we should have these arms control agreements. In 2010, President Obama, President Medvedev negotiated a limit that neither side could have more than 1,550 nuclear weapons, strategic, and that treaty expires. And that will mean for the first time in almost two generations, both sides can deploy however many nuclear weapons they want. And both sides will begin to suspect that they are falling behind and therefore that they need to deploy more. And of course, the other side will see the country deploying more and say, well, if they're deploying more, we need to deploy more. This is the same logic that led the United States and Soviet Union to deploy 70,000 nuclear weapons between them in 1984. We now are down to about 7,000 nuclear weapons between the two of us. It's still too many, but I worry that we are going to race back up before we realize that nobody is going to benefit from this competition.
John, what's the position of the Trump administration and what you know about Vladimir Putin in Russia in terms of future negotiations to get back New Start on track? Is there a possibility that these countries in these two administrations can see their way back to something which I think to most people in the world makes just common sense, limit these destructive weapons that are capable of extinguishing all life on the planet?
Yeah, this is where things get really, quite frankly, surprising. Donald Trump, both before he was elected, I mean, I grew up in New York City, so I was used to Donald Trump talking about how he's the best negotiator and he could negotiate a better nuclear deal than Reagan. Has talked a lot about the nuclear threat, both in his first term and in his second term, saying he'd like to negotiate a disarmament, even complete abolition of nuclear weapons. And so last year in September, Vladimir Putin said, you know what, the New START treaty is expiring. Why don't we both agree to extend the limits for a year? Politically, we don't need to pass a treaty, but we'll stay under the limit if you stay under the limit. Donald Trump said, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. I'll look into it. And then he hasn't done anything. And like so many things, he says, oh, yeah, I can negotiate a better deal on Iran, on trade deals, on NAFTA, nuclear agreements with Russia. He talks a big game, but unfortunately, he can't get out of his own way. And the administration doesn't seem to have any sort of unified strategy for how to implement things the president says he wants. And so Putin gets all the political benefit of saying, I'm willing to constrain my nuclear arsenal, but the United States won't agree to it. And if he builds up, he'll say, well, I have to because the United States has basically walked away from the negotiating table. So not only do we not get the limits, but we take the blame. And so from a strategic point of view and from a political point of view, it's really a double negative for the United States.
That was John Wolfstall, Director of Global Risk at the Federation of American Scientists, and a member of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists Science and Security Board. Learn more about the Doomsday Clock and the reasons why it was moved closer to midnight by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Washington Post, for decades one of the nation's preeminent investigative news outlets, which broke major stories like the Watergate scandal, laid off some 300 employees, one-third of its workforce, on February 4th. Jeff Bezos, the multi-billionaire owner of The Washington Post, Amazon, and Blue Origin, relies on favorable treatment by Donald Trump to retain valuable government contracts. Since just before the 2024 election, Bezos has very publicly shaped the Post's editorial policy to quash criticism of Trump. What's happened at The Washington Post fits a pattern across U.S. media where Trump's verbal attacks, multi-million-dollar lawsuits, and threats to revoke FCC licenses from broadcast outlets have succeeded in causing some of the nation's most powerful media companies to surrender to Trump. Media CEOs have paid out millions of dollars in settlements in frivolous lawsuits, fired program hosts critical of Trump, including CBS late-night TV host Stephen Colbert, suspended ABC host Jimmy Kimmel, and canceled the CBS 60 Minutes News magazine story critical of Trump's deportation of men to El Salvador. Trump-aligned billionaires like David Ellison, founder of Skydance Media, and CEO of Paramount, backed by his tech billionaire father Larry Ellison, are now reshaping the U.S. media industry. Your reporter spoke with Victor Picard, the C. Edwin Baker Professor of Media Policy and Political Economy at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication. Here, Professor Picard assesses the danger posed to democracy by the right-wing oligarchs now buying up media properties that could dramatically impact political news coverage and cultural content.
Paramount Skydance controlling CBS and immediately pushing them dramatically to the right. And of course, most recently, what we have seen is this recent acquisition of, you know, Netflix buying or in the process of buying Warner Brothers Discovery, which has many holdings, including CNN. But then as soon as this was announced, the Ellison-controlled Paramount Skydance conglomerate tried to make a hostile bid to buy out Warner Brothers Discovery in place of Netflix. So we see this, basically these two major media conglomerates fighting over yet another major media conglomerate. And meanwhile, you know, this sets it up. We know that Paramount Skydance has close ties to the Trump administration. So they're doing everything they can to try to get favor, especially regulatory favor, in order to acquire Warner Brothers. And this just creates all these leverages, all these leverage points and vulnerabilities for what we're seeing is a kind of corporate capture of our entire media system, and really, to be more specific, media oligarchic capture. And it tends to be very right-wing politically. So when we see these structural shifts happen, we're also seeing how it manifests at the level of media content, again, skewing our media to the right. And this is dangerous for democratic society by any measure, by any standard.
Victor, we have a federal system of regulation, but so often in the past it has failed to regulate in the public interest in the view of many people who criticize the concentration of media ownership and the lack of variety in so many ways in our major media outlets. If you could reshape the FCC, the SEC, and other regulatory bodies, what kinds of changes would you recommend be made in the future, if we have a future?
Yeah, that's an open question. I mean, there are a number of changes that I would love to see happen. And at the very least, you know, we need to reassert this public interest principle that has been just withering away in the years leading up to our current moment. It's not like this just happened yesterday. It's been a long-term, long-developing historical process. But really, one way of looking at it is that there are these three levels of capture. I think the first stage of capture was the commercialization of our entire media system, in that we did not have a predominantly public system, as many democratic countries did, such as the UK had the BBC, and most democracies around the world have these strong public media systems. We started out with a hyper-commercialized broadcast media system. So that kind of capitalistic stage of capture was number one. The second one was this corporate capture that we keep referring to, where because our media is being treated as these commodities and not as a public service that democracy requires, it tees it up for these handful of corporations and oligarchs to buy up more and more of our media. So that's sort of step two, stage two of media capture. But then the third one is this kind of authoritarian capture, that once you have all these oligarchs in power, it's quite easy for an autocratic authoritarian figure to, you know, basically rely on these friendly oligarchs to capture the media system for the government. And that's kind of where we are today. And so I think the best thing we can do to try to create an alternative system would be to really focus on that first stage of capture, which is to try to take our media out of this commercial system so that it's not just profit-driven, it actually focuses on serving democracy first. So that really would be, I think, something we need to at least have on our horizon for the future, is to work towards a more public media-oriented system that is not so profit-driven, that is not, you know, sitting there to be bought up by these oligarchs, and that can't be so easily captured by an authoritarian government. It's not something we will be able to do tomorrow, but it's something that we need to work towards if we care about having any semblance of democracy in the future.
And what we're seeing unfold now, and you can sort of provide some more detail here, is part of a blueprint that we've seen unfold in Hungary under their authoritarian leader, Viktor Orban, as well as what we saw happen in Russia after the perestroika, after Yeltsin took over and right around the time Putin came to power, where there was a vast sell-off of the media system to oligarchs aligned with the leader.
That's exactly right. It's a well-worn playbook by this point, where these authoritarian figures realize that they don't have to take over their media outlets by gunpoint, right? They can rely on friendly media oligarchs to take over these media institutions and then just flood the zone with their preferred narratives and to really snuff out any capacity for dissenting views.
That was Viktor Picard, professor of media policy and political economy at the Annenberg School for Communication, where he co-directs the Media Inequality and Change Center. Find links to Picard's recent commentaries and related analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Since 1967, first-year students at Yale University's School of Architecture have each year worked on designing and building a home in poor and working-class neighborhoods all over New Haven, Connecticut. For the past few years, the school has entered into an agreement with the Friends Center for Children to build rent-free housing for the Innovative Daycare Center's early childhood educators. The architecture school's Jim Vlock first-year building project, as it's known, has thus far built four homes at the Children's Center, creating a village where families support each other and socialize together. The project has future plans to build at least three more homes on the site. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Adam Hopfner, director of the project, who talks about the design of the homes and the positive impact free housing has on the teachers' ability to do their job.
The ethos of the building project has always been raising social consciousness and providing design services for, you know, a part of the community that is often so underserved by architecture. We're working on the fourth of four homes that are on this one site, and we've effectively created a village. And in fact, when they acquired the site, they acquired a building, a residence on that site. And then there's almost 2 acres of property behind that. But we essentially developed a sort of a village plan with the Friends Center and went through all the various agencies. We had support from the city, which was wonderful. And ultimately, we had support from the neighborhood as well. You know, there was resistance to some change, and that's understandable. We've tried to be really good neighbors in terms of trying to minimize the impact and sight lines from the existing houses.
So are they considered single family? Because it sounds like they're kind of two family, but they share a kitchen, but everything else is separate?
They are legal single families, just to be clear. The first house and the second house both are three bedrooms, single kitchen, single dining area. But, you know, it goes to question what is a family? You know, what does a family consist of? Is it Ozzy and Harriet and 2.5 children? And the vast majority of households are not Ozzy and Harriet. And so we're completely compliant with the zoning regulations. And it just so happens that sometimes there are two different sort of constituents who are sharing a house. And so in the case of the house in 23 and the house in 24, again, they were both three-bedroom houses. But the way it was arranged, there's one sort of quote-unquote unit, which has two bedrooms, a bathroom, and a sort of a living space. And then another unit has a bedroom and a bathroom and a living space. And it's all under one roof, and it's all within the same footprint. And then they share a sort of an entryway and a kitchen and dining area.
So far, all the ones you've built are in this one spot. Do you know where else you're going to be building?
We're in process right now of looking for various sites. We really feel like this, the model of community living or village living, is seems to be really sort of resonates with the people who live there. You know, we're working with the Friends Center, we're working with the folks in the city of New Haven to look to try to identify a property that could perhaps accommodate sort of multiple homes.
This whole project addresses this critical problem of people not earning enough in the daycare field to be able to support themselves, basically.
I'm sure you know, like, the rate of turnover in this profession is extreme because it's not, you know, it's simply not affordable. So, and the stresses that these teachers have, you know, they're doing such important work, and yet the stresses that they bring, it has to impact the way in which they teach and how they care for their children. And so this idea of providing housing as part of the compensation package, it's such an opportunity to provide for a level of stability, financial stability, and the emotional stability that comes with that. And I'm sure that, you know, the turnover rate is significantly reduced because that stressor has been alleviated.
This is all like sweat equity or whatever you call it by the part of the, you and the students, right? So that doesn't cost anything, but there's still a cost. So who pays like for the permitting and who pays for the materials and all that?
We worked with Friends Center to say, like, this is how much we think ultimately, just given our experience of building, this is how much it's going to cost us to build these projects. They actually fundraise and provide the money for the material costs and the like. What we do is we bring, as you say, our sweat equity. I mean, I would hope that our intellectual capital is worth something. So we bring, you know, we bring our designs, and we do a tremendous amount of begging, essentially, for materials and in-kind donations. So we tend to build these houses for certainly less than half what it would otherwise cost. And we do it in half the time that it would otherwise typically take to build these things.
That was Adam Hopfner, director of the Jim Vlock First Year Building Project at the Yale School of Architecture. Learn more about the school's home building projects in New Haven by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WXOJ in Northampton, Massachusetts, WDRT in Viroqua, Wisconsin, KMUD in Shelter Cove, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.